Well, good afternoon. It's so nice to be here with you. Thank you, Steve. Is the sound working okay?
I'm gonna be louder.
Should I talk louder or? Oh, good. How's that? Better? Good enough? No, louder, louder. I don't want to talk too much louder or my voice will go bad. So how's that? Is that better?
Yeah.
Or it's the same? It's the same, okay. Poor John has to crawl under the bench. Okay, how's that? Is that better? I can hear it better myself. I can tell I'm talking. So, it's very nice to be here with you and a little bit exciting for me. And I just did my first full bows since my hip surgery. So that was a big thing. I'm going to talk today about the Dhammapada, which is what we've been studying in our Everyday Zen seminar. And we can all, it doesn't matter whether you know anything about it or have ever heard of it or not, that's fine for what I'm talking about today. Hatred never ends through hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. You may have heard this verse. It's probably the best known verse in the Dhammapada, which is one of the most, which is one of the oldest and most beloved of Buddhist texts. It's a condensation of some of the Buddha's essential teachings, and it was passed on orally for hundreds of years until it was written down on palm leaves about 500 years after his death. The Dhammapada is refreshingly straightforward, a down-to-earth condensation of early Buddhist teachings, as I said a moment ago. And the words are easy to understand. It's less than 100 pages long, short and to the point. It's kind of the opposite of the Gandavyuha Sutra, which we were most recently studying in the seminar before the Dhammapada. And the Gandavyuha Sutra is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages long, way, way longer than the Dhammapada. And the text is very ornate. There's pages and pages of lists of precious jewels and beautiful palaces and long lists of fantastic names of bodhisattvas. So it's wonderful and it's full of teachings on love, but it's very, very different from the Dhammapada, which is kind of a welcome change by being so to the point and easy to follow after the Gandavyuha. It's a good beginner's text, actually, and it's good for experienced people, too. It consists of 423 verses, and each verse is four lines long. Some translations keep the form of verse, and some are in prose, but either way, each verse is said to be a saying of the Buddha. And my quotations will come from three different translations, most of them by Gil Fronsdale, and some from Tanisaro and Juan Mascaro. So I won't tell you each time who translated it, but most of them are Gil Fronsdale. So here are the first two verses. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. That's the first verse. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So those two verses are almost identical with just a few words changed to say two opposite sides of the situation. what happens with a corrupted mind and what happens with a peaceful mind. So they're laying out the basic principle of the Dhammapada, that is through training the mind that we can find freedom. It's urging us to let go of craving and let go of attachments, let go of preferences. We live now in a society whose economy is based on consumerism, where the very purpose of the massive advertising industry is to cultivate desire. So letting go of craving is probably even more challenging for us now than it was in Buddha's day. I've been practicing for a long time, and I must admit that all this time I've been trying to find the freedom that comes when one is not clinging to outcomes. There has been a kind of pain inherent in my practice as I observe my gaining mind. This is not to say that I don't really, really appreciate the stillness and solidity and peacefulness and quiet that comes with Zazen practice. I do. I'm so grateful for it. But this is another aspect of my practice that I am confessing to you. I still want my Buddhist practice, my Zazen practice, to bring me freedom from clinging, even though I am continuing to observe how powerful my clinging still is and how far I am from the freedom that I long for. Where is it? When am I going to get it? Sometimes I get discouraged thinking that the Buddhist teachings ask more of me than I can do, more than I can give. Can I really and truly let go of attachments? Can I let go of the wish for my loved ones not to suffer? Can I let go of the wish for the Democrats to turn everything around in the midterm elections? Can I let go of my sense of having a self? No, I can't do those things because I'm a human being. But I can move in that direction. Early in my life, I made an attempt to train myself to let go of self-clinging, though I never would have said it in those words. When I was 10, I went through a brief period of thinking that I was a selfish person and that I should do something about it. In retrospect, I don't think I was any more selfish than your average 10-year-old, but for some reason, I was unusually aware of it. I wanted to be a good person. But please don't think I was a goody-goody. I trespassed into the neighbors' yards to climb their trees. I stole an antique pillbox off my grandmother's dresser. I snuck into the kitchen when nobody was in there and stole Oreo cookies out of the package. Well, we used to call them Hydrox cookies, and then they turned into Oreo cookies, which weren't quite as good as the Hydrox cookies. But maybe I'm the only person in this room who remembers Hydrox cookies. No. So I even was joining others to tease a boy in our third grade class who had no other sin except that he was gangly and awkward. So I was not a goody-goody child. But all my life, I have wondered, what is it to be a person? And I think my investigation about being selfish or unselfish was born of this curiosity. Where did I end and the other person begin? Why couldn't we all read each other's minds? These were questions I had in my mind, sometimes without words attached to them. At any rate, I embarked on a training program, a self-improvement training program, of doing extra things for people, doing favors for my parents, like clearing the table before they asked me to, or giving a favorite book to a friend to train myself in being generous. But I saw that I was only doing these things in order to be praised, or because I wanted people to like me better. And I knew that that was very selfish. So I took the next step. I did generous things for others without telling them so that I wouldn't get any credit, like emptying the teacher's wastebasket at recess or leaving a packet of M&Ms in the school desk of someone who wasn't particularly my friend and wouldn't guess that I had done it. This didn't last long. I said to myself, You're not doing this to be kind. You're doing this so you can tell yourself what a great person you are. My self-training program hadn't worked. I threw up my hands in despair and abandoned the whole project, at least for the time being. At some level, I'm still struggling with this very concern. I still want everybody to like me. I still want to be a good person. Sometimes I think there's something wrong with me for wanting those things at this age, especially by now, at the age of 83, I trust that enough people like me and that I believe that I'm a good enough person. So why do I continue with these childish yearnings? Maybe it's just part of life, part of who I am, but it's getting to be a smaller and smaller part, hopefully. Reading the Dhammapada this time, I thought at first, oh no, here we go again. Here's another teaching that is telling me to do the impossible. Here's an example. As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a wise person is unmoved by praise or blame. So what about when I have a book or an article published? I do care whether it's met with praise or blame. And you don't have to be a writer to care. Whatever work you do, if it matters to you, if you put your heart into it, can you be unmoved by whether the response is praise or blame? Here's another challenging verse. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the wise person shows no sign of being elated or depressed. How could I ever be a wise person like this? We're lucky enough to have a hot tub at our house, and I may well have prattled about how good it feels to get into it on a cold morning. As for the last line of the verse, the wise person shows no sign of being elated or depressed. Well, when an old friend whom I haven't seen for a long time comes to visit, I certainly show signs of elation and rush to the door and give the person a big hug. So that's a hard one. Another verse says, the person who has eliminated clinging is the ultimate person. I want to say to the Dhammapada, you've got to be kidding. The path is impossible. What hope is there for me? How can I ever drop self-concern? But wait, as I was reading, everything spun around and I had an aha moment. The Dhammapada is an early version of a self-help book. The Dhammapada is not addressing sages who have already attained a selfless state and are free from suffering. What would be the point of that? The teaching is meant to help us, not lecture us. Here's a verse. Whoever recovers from doing evil by doing something wholesome illuminates the world like the moon set free from a cloud. This is reassuring because a regular person can do something that could be called evil, and that same regular person could recover from it by doing something you could call wholesome. The book is addressing people like you and me, people who are not yet free from the suffering of clinging, not completely, and who need encouragement, who could use some suggestions about how to train themselves, ourselves, to walk the path. You can learn by modeling yourself on wise and admirable people, as the Dhammapada reminds us. But in the end, you are the only one who can help yourself. You are the one who can help yourself the best. The Dhammapada is giving us friendly encouragement. The text says, happiness is steadfast faith. This includes steadfast faith in oneself and in one's good intentions. I can do this. I can walk the path. Going back to the opening lines, what we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. The Dhammapada emphasizes training the mind. Joy can come with training the mind. To train is to change. You train a dog to change its behavior. Changing habits of thinking is extremely difficult, but all Dharma teachings, in fact, Buddhist practice itself, is based on the idea that it is possible. Changing karmic patterns is an ongoing process. It's not something we're ever finished with. That's the point. This is what our lives are made of. If my thoughts of today build my life of tomorrow, then how about putting aside my negative self-talk, in this case, my idea that I can never be free from self-clinging. Over and over, the text says, I'm the one who can train myself. It's important, Buddha tells us, to keep company with the wise and to learn from them. But it's up to me to change my habits of thinking. It's up to me, and I am up to it. The Dhammapada wants me to succeed. Buddha tells me to be tender with myself. Here's a verse. If one knew oneself to be precious, one would guard oneself with care. Sages will watch over themselves all through the night. I'm grateful to Buddha for his encouragement, or her encouragement. Buddha is cheering me on. When Shakyamuni gave these teachings, he was addressing an ordained audience of monks and nuns. But the teachings are a guide to living for everyone, not just monastics. Not by matted hair, not by clan, not by birth does one become a wise person. The one in whom there is truth and a dharma is the one who is pure, the one who is wise. Fool, what use is matted hair? What use is a deerskin robe? The tangled jungle is within you, and you groom the outside. And you groom the outside, mistakenly. So just because a person is of the priestly caste or an ascetic practicing renunciation in the jungle wearing a deer skin to keep warm or to stay cold, maybe, that doesn't guarantee awakening. A person of any class and clan and category can train the mind to let go of clinging and to make room for more joy. When I saw the Dhammapada from this new perspective, I was reminded of Ben Franklin's self-improvement program, which made a big impression on me when I read it in his autobiography many decades ago. He made a list of 13 virtues to be cultivated. Here are a few of them that are consistent with Buddhist practice. Sincerity. Be truthful and just in your thoughts and speech. Justice. Do not wrong others and fulfill your duties. Tranquility. Remain calm in the face of minor disturbances or unavoidable events. Franklin focused on one of his 13 virtues each week, cycling through the entire list 4 times a year. It was very methodical, his system. And every morning he would ask himself, what good shall I do today? And at night he would ask, what good have I done today? So I mention this as an early self-improvement program that I was aware of. And I tried it myself. I made a chart. I like self-improvement charts. And I checked things off. I can't say it made much difference, but I think now that it was because I was doing this in a vacuum, not telling anybody else. I was kind of embarrassed about it, I guess. I could have used some support from others, like the support we get from the Sangha when we're studying the precepts. It was like a New Year's resolution that you keep for a few days before sliding back into old habits. These days, you can find many books on how to be happy in the bookstore. Not how to be happy in the bookstore, but you can find many books in the bookstore on how to be happy. But you can also learn to be, or you don't even have to learn, you can just be happy in the bookstore, if you're me. And if you're still lucky enough to have a bookstore in your neighborhood. I used to feel a little disdainful whenever I saw a book called How to Be Happy on an acquaintance's bookshelf. You think you can get happy just from reading a book, I thought. But since then, I have changed my arrogant attitude to something more like, oh, I'll try anything. As Shakyamuni said, every person wants happiness. Why should I be embarrassed about it? I've read several books on how to be happy now, including a book co-written by the Dalai Lama called The Art of Happiness. If he wrote a book on the subject, that makes it legitimate. He writes, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. And if you want yourself to be happy, practice compassion. I pulled a couple of books pertaining to happiness off my bookshelf. A good one is MindSight, The New Science of Personal Transformation by Daniel Siegel. He's a psychiatrist and a mindfulness teacher in LA. He writes, my clinical research has shown me that mindfulness is a form of mental activity that changes the mind to become aware of awareness itself and to pay attention to one's own intention. This kind of mindfulness falls into the category of training, and Siegel uses this training to help patients get grounded and not be controlled by rage or grief. Another helpful book is called Thoughts and Feelings, Taking Control of Your Mind and Your Life. It's a workbook based on cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT is a relatively short-term form of therapy in which the patient learns to train their own mind using techniques and exercises that help them let go of fear and anxiety. Here, too, the emphasis is on training. I'm grateful to the Dhammapada for allowing us to want to be happy. In the Theravada tradition, that's okay. You can say it out loud. I think of Vipassana teacher James Barras's year-long course, Awakening Joy. He created this course about 20 years ago and taught it in a big hall in Berkeley, but it has been available to people to take online all over the world. Thousands and thousands of people have taken this course. I took it myself for a year. It too is a training program with certain exercises and homework assignments. I particularly appreciated James's inclusion of gratitude practice. Every night before you go to bed, write down three things you're grateful for from that day. I highly recommend that practice to anybody at any time. It's very encouraging and therapeutic when you discover, when you really think about how much there is to be grateful for, that you forget about when you're complaining to yourself about something. James is not teaching about a selfish kind of happiness. He's talking about the kind of joy that connects you to everyone and makes you want to help others. You want to help them be happy along with yourself. He's a Vipassana teacher whose mindfulness practice is interwoven with a commitment to working for social and environmental justice. He's been doing that for many years. Self-help books and programs about happiness, the good ones anyway, do not tell us how to get things like a new car as much as they tell us how to find happiness inside in our minds and hearts without changing our outward circumstances. We may think we will be happy in a different external situation, and perhaps we will be for a little while. But as you know, when you have satisfied one particular craving, another one comes along behind it pretty quickly. So how do you go about training yourself? Here are two verses from the chapter on craving. Surrounded by craving, people run around like frightened hares, held by fetters and bonds. The stream flows everywhere. The creeper of craving sprouts and remains. Seeing that the creeper has sprouted, use insight to cut it out at the root. The more you learn to be aware of awareness, the quicker you notice it when the creeper of craving first sprouts. That's the time to disempower it. I have a friend who is a skillful and devoted potter whose work is greatly respected. Every day, her greatest joy is to go into her studio to make beautiful bowls, mugs, platters, ewers, teapots, wall vases. That's her favorite place to be. The last time we were taking our weekly walk, I caught myself thinking, I wish I had one craft that I build my life around and that gives me as much joy as she gets from making pots. I wish I felt that way about writing. Sometimes it gives me joy and sometimes it doesn't. But quickly, I noticed my own craving. Uproot that thought, I said to myself. Be happy for her that she has that kind of joy in her life. And be happy for yourself that you are being yourself, living the life that you are living, with different focal points at the center that bring you joy. The Dhammapada offers pairs of opposites. At first glance, it seems to say that you are either a sage or a fool, that you have either a corrupted mind or a peaceful mind. But it's not as dualistic as it sounds. I believe it sets forth these opposite archetypes as the two extremes of a philosophical continuum. The Dhammapada is encouraging us to make the choices that will bring us joy. We are all somewhere in between, and we all can train ourselves in the direction of releasing suffering and opening ourselves to joy. By contrast, we are told in Zen that we don't practice in order to get anything. We don't sit zazen with gaining mind. We sit zazen to sit zazen, and if it happens to make us feel better, that's just a side benefit. Excuse me. If it makes us feel worse, don't worry about it. Just do it anyway. Every day is a good day, no matter what the weather. This point of view has its merits. If I didn't think so, I wouldn't have kept practicing for 50 years. I appreciate the training in acceptance. This is how it is right now. Don't fight it. But actually, Zen uses a different language, but it's not as different as it seems from the Dhammapada or from Theravadan practice. Zen doesn't say everything's okay. We have the precepts reminding us that it's not okay to murder and steal. We take vows to save beings from suffering. Zen respects the early Buddhist teachings, including the Dhammapada. Both Zen and the Dhammapada teach us that we create suffering for ourselves with our mind, and both teach us that letting go of clinging is at the heart of practice and that freedom and joy is possible. For a few years now, I've been trying to train myself to let go of preferences, and progress is surprisingly slow, but there has been progress. I'll give you an example. It's remarkable how often preferences come up in daily life, especially if you are sharing a household with someone, as I am with my sister and brother-in-law. We have the archetypal disagreements about how best to load the dishwasher. It seems to be something that many people argue over. So I think bowls should go on the top rack, and my sister Francie likes to put them on the bottom. When they first moved in 7 years ago, I had a strong belief in the superiority of my method, which was already well established. If I was adding the dishes to a partly loaded dishwasher, I often edited the arrangement and moved the bowls from the bottom to the top, thinking it was a more efficient use of space. But I noticed that I felt some discomfort about whether Francie would be annoyed. Thanks to my work on letting go of preferences and my increasing ability to observe my own behavior, I made an advance in letting go, and I left the dishes where they already were and added the new ones as I chose. But that seemed silly, some bowls on the top and some bowls on the bottom. Ridiculous. I asked myself, what difference does it make to me where the bowls go? I noticed that every time I approached the dishwasher with a dirty bowl in my hands, a certain anxiety rose in me about where would I put it. How important is it to fit the most possible number of bowls in the dishwasher? What's important is harmony in the family. Now I've made a further step in letting go and I load the dishwasher in the way that Francie and Bob prefer. I put the bowls on the bottom. It's such a relief. I don't have to go through any struggle about loading the dishwasher. I just do it. It's a peaceful thing to do, free of conflict. Another example, when you're going out to dinner with a friend, does it really matter which restaurant you go to? If it doesn't matter, let it go. If it does, speak up. It's great for everybody if you can loosen up your preferences, but acting like it's all the same to you, no matter what, no matter what happens, puts you in danger of turning yourself into a mere shadow of a person. I'll tell you a story about that. Years ago, I was visiting my mother and my stepfather in their apartment in Chicago. Albert was a kind and accommodating person, though not a very dynamic person or assertive. One night, the three of us were going out to dinner. I left it to Mom and Albert to decide where, since I didn't know the restaurants in the neighborhood. Mom mentioned a couple of restaurants she liked and asked Albert which he would prefer. I don't care, he said. She pushed, well, which kind of food would you prefer? I really don't care, he said. Mom shouted, care, care! She's quite annoyed. Dishwashers and restaurants are small examples, of course, but the same principle applies to more significant preferences. Preferences are a kind of craving. So, wishing for a day that's different from the one I'm in causes me suffering. And I can notice the joys of the day that I am in. I wish, for example, sometimes I find myself wishing that my children and grandchildren did not live thousands and thousands of miles away. And I wish that my broken hip was healing a little faster than it is. But it could be otherwise. It could be, I'm so lucky that I have my grandchildren and my children are in good health, and that they even are born in the world. And I'm so lucky that my hip surgery went well, and I'm mending well. And those things could be otherwise. So I'm grateful for that. I do believe I can train myself in letting go of having things go a certain way and be grateful for the way they are going. So ask yourself these three questions. Why is this so important to me? What kind of suffering is my preference causing me? How would it feel to let go of this preference? The Dhammapada says, craving gives rise to grief. Craving gives rise to fear. For someone released from craving, there is no grief, and from where would come fear? We use the word training when we are talking about our Zen practice, especially an intensive practice period. That's a kind of training. When I was in a practice period at Tassajara, it was excellent training in letting go of preferences. It didn't much bother me if we were served turnips at lunch. I don't like turnips very much. I was grateful for whatever we were served, and even grateful not to have to decide what to eat. I stopped constantly assessing everything. Do I like this? Do I not like this? If it was rainy, I put on my rain shoes. If we had a long break, I took a long walk. If we had a short break, I took a short walk. When a friend and I drove back to the Bay Area after 3 months at Tassajara, we stopped halfway at a Mexican restaurant to have lunch. It was a shock when they brought the menu. Oh my God, I would have to decide what to eat. I would have to find preferences in me. And I didn't want to do it. I had felt the happiness that can come with no picking and choosing. That attitude sort of wore off after a little while, and I did start to care what I chose to eat in a restaurant, but it was quite wonderful to realize that I had freed myself from it for a little while. It's possible to train yourself on your own, But training yourself in the context of Sangha, you have the benefit of having the support of others. You are surrounded with wise ones, and at the same time, you are learning to train yourself. Even today, right here at Green Gulch, sitting in this beautiful room together, we are surrounded by wise ones, like the person to your left and the person to your right. What a blessing to practice together. So that's my talk. And now we can go into groups of three, as is our habit. And so we'll have time in a minute for everybody to divide themselves into a group of three and try to, if possible, find people you haven't practiced with before, or if they're newcomers, try to be sure they're with some oldcomers. And then I'll give you a question to talk about. Why don't you get into the groups of three first, and then I'll give you the question. Um,